Welcome to Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast, a product of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Now here are your hosts, Dr. Eric Dorfman and Dr. Dan Dombrowski.
So welcome, listeners. Today's topic, Eric and I are going to talk a little bit about zoos and how they fit into biophilia and our sort of ideas and our hopes to introduce people to nature and encourage a love for nature.
And then after the break, we'll be talking to Pat Simmons, who is the director and CEO of the North Carolina Zoo. And it was by Mark Manellis, who is a really good friend of mine in London, wrote this about the arrival of the kangaroo into England in the 18th century, and what it meant. And first it was a dead one, and then it was they had to increase the popularity of it, so it became a stuffed one, and then they had to bring a live one. And so each sort of iteration of introducing this amazing, the kangaroo was as remote a kind of animal as possible. And this idea of spectacle and relating on a level, we can't afford as a zoo or as a museum, we can't afford to get rid of spectacle. But infusing spectacle with knowledge is a really important thing, right? So they're using spectacle nowadays to impart knowledge rather than just sensationalize a little piece of nature out of context.
I think context is critical. I think that the thing that makes it better or have value is putting it in context. And that's animal or the individual in its own context, in an environment that it's housed and maintained, where it's got enrichment, it's got, you know, people that are concerned with its welfare, or context in a environmental or habitat sense, that, you know, this is an animal that comes from a habitat and we really need to understand the habitat. So I think zoos and museums with live animals, people come to look at them, but I think you've got to turn that around, just like you said, so that that sort of brings them in. But then the good they do is getting people excited, educating people. And this idea of biophilia, you know, it's like if you can surround people in this good way with these animals in a healthy environment, that's where the positive comes from.
Right. Well, and you mentioned museums and zoos as well. This is also very much akin to the rise of the habitat diorama, as opposed to just having a stuffed animal in a glass case.
Absolutely.
Then moving on to creating the whole environment for the animal is sort of education by stealth. You know what I mean?
Right.
You're not calling out every plant in the diorama, but you're giving a habitat and maybe some sense of behavior of the grouping.
I think along those lines, I think, again, talking about habitats or complex enclosures, if we're talking about exhibits in zoos or like a museum with live animals, I think putting those animals in context really is the only way to get people to understand environments and habitats. I think the old way that you know, zoos started as these menageries of animals in boxes or cages were really pretty awful at, you know, getting people to understand the animal in context and think about habitat, because all it did was focus on the individual. People would walk away with that experience and really have no place to put that animal in their thoughts or ideas, leading to conservation or to saving habitat or protecting habitats.
And the other thing that I find really interesting is this idea of combining the human habitat with the animal's habitat. So for instance, a zoo that I quite like in New Zealand is Wellington Zoo in the capital city there. And they've taken a Tibetan temple that you need to walk through in order to be able to see the red pandas. It's been a long time since I've talked to them about it, but I think that this was actually created in Tibet for the zoo, but I may be wrong there. But the idea is that you get a sense of the kind of wonder of being there and contextualizing. It's not just an animal enclosure. and then blurring that boundary between us and them. And how do we do that in the world? How do we do that in a zoo? Does the zoo then become a microcosm of the world as a whole? It's all very complex, and I think part of it is just taste. Do you like it or not?
I think that there's sort of a fine line between making sure that those inclusion of sort of people in that habitat, in that environment, is done in a very, you know, a very honest way as far as biology and science, and not sort of from the more developed countries and areas sort of exploiting or using people or people's cultures in a way that's disrespectful. Sometimes, I mean, that's kind of the old way of zoos that I think
absolutely
we have to be super careful of.
The chimpanzee tea party sort of stereotype of what the old zoo is and what kind of the antithesis of what we want to see now.
As far as zoos, an important aspect of a zoo are these now efforts for conservation. A lot of zoos and museums and other places that display these live animals and care for them are also the leaders in their conservation and
yes.
resources
yes.
And raising money. They're animals that have been basically saved by the efforts of these facilities that have stepped in. They love them and they know the importance, and by sort of getting people excited about them and plugging in their resources, whether those resources are knowledge or money or funding or people, they can really make a difference.
Those things have to be hand in hand with habitat conservation, right? You can't save a species isolated from its context and then expect it to have somewhere to go. You can't rehabilitate a habitat with no individuals to move back into it. So it's a fantastic partnership, needs to be there.
Again, a sort of new way of zoos. We talk about zoos have come together really globally. There's a group, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, that have really its leadership by Zoos and Aquarium to form an organization to provide accreditation so that they can recognize those facilities that are really doing what they should do and have right. high standards of care and animal husbandry and, you know, are concerned with or apply animal welfare and enrichment to their animals. And so that accreditation is really a way to recognize facilities around the world that are really doing a good job. And maybe what they do now isn't what they'll do in 10 years or won't be best in 10 years, but it's a group that really works to make those improvements and try to find the best ways to do it.
Well, and it's interesting too. We were just talking to Abe and our producer a minute ago before we got on air here about vegans having a special criticism for zoos. You know, anything kept in captivity is bad. And that was what he just mentioned. But there's a big sector of society who maybe doesn't understand what the modern zoo is and still thinks of those old kind of, you think of a big cat in a tiny cage pacing back and forth. I mean, those things in at least the accredited zoos, that doesn't happen anymore. And I think as an industry, zoos have been very responsive to the criticism that has been leveled at them at different times in their history, which really has never been leveled against natural history museums. In our related field, we're usually, our stereotype is that we're old and dusty, which is, of course, also wrong, right? But very much, I think zoos have been excellent at saying, we need to modernize, but we also need to take the real conservation work and turn it out to the people who are coming and visiting, so that zoos are now primarily conservation organizations.
Right.
And who display, rather than display organizations who also do a bit of conservation.
With this accreditation, particularly with this group, the AZA group, you know, it's important to have messages of education. They focus instead of on numbers of species where you just have as many as you can, you know, fit into your property. It's about target species that they can give good habitats to, and they can focus on if it's needed or necessary, captive breeding or habitat restoration. So now, instead of just having one of everything, you know, the idea is to really focus energies in a more productive, effective way to save species in these cases.
There are many species that would be extinct without the efforts of zoos. Right. And that's absolutely critical.
I think that's going to become more and more evident as we move forward. I think they're really going to play a key role in helping make the connection. As habitats and nature become harder to access for folks, the role of, you know, zoos and facilities with these collections doing it right are going to be the gateway to really help people connect.
And the other thing that I think is also really interesting, and Pat's going to talk about this in a little bit, I think, the areas in zoos between the cages, right? So what sort of environment are you in? Increasingly educational, it's increasingly immersive, right? So it's not just a fun park that you walk from cage to cage and you pick up an ice cream on the way. It's also contextualizing the species. It's thinking about those are the places where the survival actions for the species, that's where they're displayed. So, you know, they're using every sort of part of a zoo to advance their message.
Our zoo here in North Carolina, the North Carolina Zoo, is the largest in the world as far as their property under their care. And only a fraction of the property they have is developed for the zoo itself. And as you said, there's a lot of spaces sort of within and around the zoo that I think in their case makes it a really wonderful opportunity to have species that need a lot of space, but then also to provide for those native species in the native habitat on zoo property that, you know, also have to coexist with the zoo animals that are on exhibit.
What you said just made me think of something else too. When I think about North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, one of the goals that I think we all share there is that the museum should be a portal to the rest of the world, right? You're not just coming to the museum for its own sake, but you're going through the museum to the rest of the natural world. And zoos in some ways also do, I mean, they do the exact same thing, right? There, you may not be able to go to Africa physically, but to get you outside into nature and thinking about the things that you're seeing around you is, I think, an important goal for them. And of course, North Carolina Zoo, because they have tracks and trails all around the zoo.
To put numbers to it, the North Carolina Zoo, I believe, has about 2,500 acres.
The whole property is 2,500 acres, of which 500 is the zoo proper.
So in their case, it's amazing because they can focus on both their global species and global projects as a zoo, but also on those native species that live on the zoo property as well. So a lot of opportunities for education and conservation.
You know, that's wonderful.
Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast, is a production of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Each episode explores our connection with nature on a personal, physical, and scientific level that enables us to live better and more responsibly on the planet. This podcast was made possible by a donation from the Burt's Bees Foundation and Burt's Bees to the Friends of the Museum of Natural Sciences. Now, on to our interview.
Pat, welcome to the show. It is so wonderful to have you here.
It is terrific to be here. Thanks. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too. This is great. Great to
have
you.
Really. Yeah, it's great. And we've been wanting to have you on the show since we first started thinking about this podcast. So what I'd love to do first is just ask you to talk a little bit about the zoo. I know it's the world's largest zoo by square area. And
my favorite zoo too, just to officially put that out there.
There you go. And it's easy to see why when you have a look at everything that's there. But also, I know that the people listening, especially the younger listeners, would probably really love to hear how you got to be where you are.
Well, first, let me talk a little bit about the North Carolina Zoo. You know, I've been doing zoo work now for a few decades. I don't want to say anything too loudly. But I can't tell you how thrilled I am to be at the North Carolina Zoo. It really is a global zoo. It is the world's largest natural habitat zoo. it is huge when you go to it. So when people think of zoo, they really are not thinking of North Carolina, which is this giant forest where we put natural habitat exhibits. And if you choose to walk the zoo, you can plan on a hike of about 6 miles one direction.
Wow.
So it is very large.
Do you have a stretcher at the other end?
We do have EMTs.
That's good.
That's a good thing, yes. And when it was initially designed, it was designed by continent. And we have currently the North America continent and the Africa continent. And the zoo does conservation work in both of those areas, boots on the ground. And as we move forward, the next plan is to build the Asia continent. And we are starting all of our conservation programs and joint zoo cooperatives over in Asia right now as well. So it's pretty exciting what we're working on.
So how did you get interested in all this stuff, right? I mean, you said you've been doing this a long time. So how did you know you wanted to sort of be in this realm with zoos and nature and animals?
Well, I didn't.
Okay, fair enough.
It's career planning.
Actually, you know, I grew up on a private trout hatchery. It was an all-men's fishing club, and I was outside all the time, and I was working in nature and doing all that stuff. I loved biology. I desperately wanted to do that job. I wanted to be the director there.
Wow.
But I was the wrong gender.
As
a result of that, I went off to try my hand at other things. And actually, very unusual background in that I went into art and I loved art and I loved that creative talents and that sort of creative process. And I love the sciences and I love biology. And one thing I quickly found out is I'm not a good enough artist to pay to feed me.
So that's like a thread though, right? I mean, Erica, guests so far, all of our guests have really had a connection with the art and sciences and nature. And I think that's great.
And, you know, I mean, that's kind of on some level, the essence of biophilia there too, is that the integrating hearts and minds. So, and we want to talk about that a little more in a bit, but keep going, Pat.
Yeah, this is please, please.
So we've got from trout to art to
to starving, and
right?
Then
yes, or not thereof.
Yes, and then, well, basically, when I had to get out into the world and figure out my own way, I did decide to take some business classes in order to try to balance my life and be able to earn my own way. And that was one of the best things that happened to me because I was married at that time to my husband, who I'm still married to, who's a university professor. And in the early years of being a professor, you often change your location about once a year because you're a visiting professor, you're filling in. And so we bounced around a lot of different places until he finally came to a place for a tenure track position. And so I started looking seriously for work. And I had the opportunity to work at a previous university in their fundraising. I'd backed up my business. I had the art background, science background. And then all of a sudden, the zoo job opened up in that little town. It was a dumpy, dumpy little zoo. And no,
we won't say where it is.
We would have gone there. But I walked in thrilled because it was everything that my heart wanted. Mm-hmm. It was all about science and it was about animals and it was about saving the world. And it was about connecting people with nature and giving their families a great time away from their normal hectic lives. Mm. And I could run the business. Plus, I got to design all of these great exhibits and do complete layouts. So it was like the creative process with the business thing, with all of
this
stuff,
of course.
With people just kind of bundled together. And I stayed there a very long time. And I'd like to think when I left it, it was no longer a dumpy little zoo, but in fact, a crown jewel.
Yes. Oh, no, that's wonderful. What I'd love to do, and it's so exciting what you're achieving in North Carolina now, and I definitely want to talk more about that, and especially the conservation work. But let's think about biophilia for a little bit. Ed Wilson, E.O. Wilson has said, defined biophilia as humanity's innate connection with nature. And it seems to me that a zoo setting is a perfect opportunity for people to balance the emotive as well as the intellectual part of their relationship to nature, animals, and in your case, lots of forest as well. And so just wondering what you think about the role of zoos in that emotive stream of thinking, and also how what your zoo does to enhance that.
Well, you know, for professional zoos today, that is one of the things that we really do and do best. The ability for us to reach out to large masses of people and give them that up close personal experience with nature, a safe place to go to, a place where you can rely on experts to talk about what they are seeing and dispel myths and fears and bring in joy. Those are all things that we need in our lives, and they are just incredibly important to the human soul. So I live my life around the word authentic. And so when people really become authentic, they are down to that place where they just feel honest about things. And when you're in nature, you can feel the most honest. At least that's my opinion. Sitting outside, I mean, why else would they have sleep sounds on your cell phone that sound like crickets at night?
Oh, yeah.
Waves and rushing water and all those kind of things. The idea is that it allows us to make that connection that people may not even realize they need to have. And it is incredibly important that once they discover that, they will have been touched in a way that will make a difference for the wildlife that they see as well as for their lives. At least I think that.
I'm dying to ask you about, I enjoy the zoo. I love the zoo. I love the sort of global aspect. As I said, North Carolina truly is my favorite zoo. I've been to many around, at least around the U.S. You guys have such a balance of native habitat. You know, you've got a lot of property and a lot of opportunities for native wildlife. What do you think about that as an experience at a zoo? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, it is in my thoughts, it is the way to present animals, presenting them in as close to their natural environment as you can, to be able to show herds of Thompson gazelles literally running across acres of land, doing the swimming back and forth motion that they make when they're scampering along. That's a great way for people to experience it. So many places are only large enough to keep animals in a relatively confined location. And people have come to expect that. So often when they come to North Carolina Zoo, they're like, holy cow, you have to walk 2 miles to get between exhibits. But, you know, that's kind of the point. You need to be out in nature and seeing what it might be really like if you were to explore and find them in their native habitats.
Wow. What about your experiences in nature? Are there things that you love that sort of stick out for you personally?
I just love sitting under a tree in the woods. As long as you don't sit in chiggers, I'm good.
Fair enough. Something that, you know, thinking about, I mean, I know when I was very young, the thing that I pestered my parents to do all the time was go to the zoo. That was the one thing. Birthdays, great post report cards, anything, it had to be the zoo. And that release that you can have there, and it's just transportive. It's outside your own realm of experience, yet it's still bounded by a cage, and it's still, your work is thinking a lot about conservation. Right. So you're wanting to take people and use this as a portal, at least an intellectual portal, to go out to the rest of nature and the rest of what you're doing in terms of conservation. So I'm just wondering how you, in a zoo setting, you say, well, okay, here's this animal, even though in your case it's an extremely large fenced area, they're still captive animals. And how you make that connection for people that this is representative of something out in the world, and then talk about what you're doing there.
When people come to a zoo, they are looking for some type of experience, some type of reward. And recognizing why they're coming is one of the first things that I think is the responsibility of a good leader. They're coming for many different reasons. Some of them want to be outside. Some of them want to be with their family. Some of them are looking for just a break from the routine. Others really want to see animals. Others are there to try to make a difference for those animals. One of the things I'd like to think that zoos can do is we can take people where they're at and help connect them to where we're at in our personal journeys. And where they are gives us an opportunity to invite them in to see those cute animals with big eyes and the uniqueness and the, you know, the crazy, that animal must have been built by committee kind of reaction, where it is so different. Nobody knows where it came from. And to begin to create that conversation with them. And so they want to come back, and then they get to know the animals and their personalities the more they come back. And they begin to find out that each one is an individual and each one has its own unique way of approaching its life. Getting to know them in that way makes it a very heartstring important piece. At least I feel it does. And then once they get to know our animals, then they will understand that that animal has a whole bunch of relatives and cousins and neighbors that live far away, but that's their natural place that they are or they should be. And what does it mean for us as a generation, as a society, as individuals, to look after those places? And so you can continue the conversation of how we're trying to save the world. We're literally trying to keep these places up and functioning and working, these biological hotspots of diversity, that recognizing that relationship with that one charismatic animal, say, I just love tigers. They don't realize that if you protect the habitat for the tigers, you're protecting this entire ecosystem of plants and animals and stuff, insects, whatever. And that is what we're trying to help people understand and recognize.
Zoos have really come a long ways in the last, 30, 50 years, right? So what you're describing, I think an important aspect of zoos, either on that journey from really a menagerie of animals to really more conservation and education based. And you guys are doing lots of like global projects, right, that connect what you have at the zoo to those habitats in the rest of the world.
Yes, we really are. And I would think we weren't doing our job if we weren't doing that, either funding it, working with partners, or having boots on the ground in those places, because the animals need our help. It's just that simple. When you look at where zoos started, they almost always were started by somebody wanting to present some king or queen with one of the most unusual creatures that they had in their world.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
And they picked it up and transplanted it in the middle of some city somewhere. Then the next level that seemed to have come after that was the scientific study of the uniqueness of those animals, but it wasn't recognizing the rest of the story. The rest of the story about animals is the same as the rest of the story for humans. There are interrelationships, there's space that you prefer to be in, their individual personalities, there's uniqueness of how they go about living their life or the kinds of foods that they want. All of those things are built around a broader view of who they are in their natural history. But then it also, at a zoo, it comes down to the individual personality. We then can walk in and say, oh yeah, I know this animal, and I know that this is what they prefer to do, or this is their favorite treat, or different things like that, which personalize it for our guests. And then in the process of looking at that, knowing that we are working very hard to keep the welfare and the life of that animal in top-notch condition so that they feel like they're living a very full and happy life. But then also recognize the conservation aspect of this. Someplace else in the world, those animals are not being treated well. They're being culled and hunted and poached, and trying to work together with other like-minded people to protect those spaces is what we're doing. We're literally involved in lots of programs in Africa and now Asia, and then, of course, saving animals right here in North Carolina. We have the second largest population of red wolves, the most endangered canid in the world. The red wolf used to be very prolific on the eastern seaboard and in the southeastern states, and now it is the most endangered canid in the world. And literally going extinct in the wild at one point. And it's been because of zoos and the federal government working together, we've been able to bring the population back, but we're still working very hard to have a release site. Right now, North Carolina is the only state, only location in the world that actually has wild red wolves on the ground. And that is an example of that kind of work. It takes a lot of time, a lot of dedication. It's fascinating. I love it. But I wish it could move faster.
Yes. One of the things that we, you know, we've been talking about connecting people to these stories and this amazing work you're doing, and something that we've been thinking a lot about behind the scenes about how we will address it in this podcast is biophilic design. So how do you design a space that helps people enjoy nature and really appreciate it perhaps in a transcendent way? And your zoo, as Dan was mentioning, has, and you did too, a lot of wild spaces, but also natural habitats. Yeah. But when you think about designing, say, a new exhibit, or in your case, a new continent, are you taking into consideration this sort of idea of biophilia and connecting people to the wild space? I'll use that in air quotes, the wild spaces that they're in.
Absolutely. We are looking to try to find ways that people can engage in the world that we see and we live in as professional scientists and folks that work in nature. And this is the part that I absolutely love about my background, is that the creative process is the process that takes all of these disparate pieces and parts and sits down and looks to how you can put them together in the most elegant way. And the elegant way is the way that it gets to the point, the cleanest, the fastest, and the most effective way. So you look at all the elements that go into a zoo design. First of all, we want to make sure that our animals are in very large spaces, that they have everything that they would need as an animal in their natural habitat. For example, the new tundra exhibit for the polar bears. Whether you know it or not, there's a chilling rock in there. There's water features. There's dig areas. There's places they can climb up. There's all kinds of different things that would allow a bear to be a bear. And so knowing the natural history of the bear or the animal that you're working with is one of the very basic things that you need to be looking at. Second thing is you need to know a little bit about the natural history of people. You know, they're going to come to these places and they're going to be thinking about what they want to accomplish. And this goes back to what I said before. Why are they there? What brings them to your place? And most of the time it's to see animals, watch the child's eyes get big and, you know, get super happy about this, share something. But in order to do that, they actually have to see the animal. And so often wild animals just as soon not be seen. They would like to be in places where you can't see them, and they just as soon be lounging around in their air-conditioned holding quarters rather than out in the heat of North Carolina. And so what do you do to deal with that? And so you set up these immersion spaces that allow people to enter into what feels like an extension of the habitat the animals are living in. So they've now, they're sharing the same substrate, they've got the same kind of trees around them or bushes or vegetation. You change up the way that it feels, so they feel like they're on an adventure with a different kind of flooring or something over their head. And then you invite them into these viewing locations. And at the same time, on the other side, you're inviting the animal into that same viewing location. So, for example, if the polar bear is hot, that's where you put the cooling rock, right up next to where people are going to want to be. And you'll go, I really want to lay on that cooling rock. Those people are not going to bother me anymore. I'm just going to lay right here. You know, it's beginning to understand the inherent nature of both people and the animals' background to try to connect them in a way that both are enjoying their life and both get a good experience out of it.
That's great. There's so much that you don't think about when you go to a zoo that is in the back. And of course, you have to keep the people out and the animals in. There's probably a lot of, you know, how far can this animal jump? Whatever, you know, so there's a whole lot of those probably logistical considerations too.
Yeah. We don't want them out.
No, definitely not.
We want them to have very, very happy lives, not. But that is a no.
Well, yes, but, and of course, that's the thing too, but the happier they are where they are, the more they consider that their home, isn't it? So it's,
it's an
amazing sort of journey you have to go on to be able to take all those things into consideration for a new exhibit.
And the other part of this too is once that exhibit is built, and trust me, I have built a couple of exhibits which the animals promptly went in there and totally tore apart. And I said, well, I wasn't getting it. Clearly, I didn't get it. But once they're there, as the keepers get to know the animals, the individual animal then starts to come out. And you quickly begin to find out the ones that like to be up high, the ones that would rather, you know, lounge over on the comfy soft spot, the ones that are going to be super thrilled to come over and watch people because they're extroverted, and others that are going to say, I don't think so, and hang back. And they're all out there. And just knowing their personalities is another cool thing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So do you think zoos really play a key role in conservation? I mean, you've talked a lot about connecting with people and the work that you guys are doing and other zoos are doing. Like, what is the role? Are zoos just really a key component in saving our biodiversity and saving our environment?
Well, I think so, yes. I think the accredited zoos in the world are. And I think that they recognize very clearly that that is one of their chief responsibilities. Just in the few decades that I've been working in the zoo field, I have seen that evolution that you were talking about. And when I first got there, there were the wars going on between who's going to have the unique animal that everybody's going to want to come in and see. Eventually, that evolved to we really need to save animals from extinction. How are we going to be doing that? And the species survival plans were created, where it's this gigantic genetic logbook dating service, where zoos actually started recognizing the animals were too valuable for us to buy and sell like they were before. They, you know, in many places, animals are still marketed. And for accredited zoos by the association, animals are not bought and sold like that anymore. They are literally shared among us on memorandums of agreement to try to put them together into the most effective breeding program, a bachelor group, a retirement group, any number of different things that we might be doing. And it's all with the intent of keeping the genetic diversity as unique as possible, so that as we're able to put them back into the wild, that they would be scientifically preserved. That was the next phase of zoos. Now we're at the following phase after that. And that phase of making sure that we scientifically approached animals well was back around the 80s. Now we're at the place that we all agree that we should not be here if we can't make a difference for the world as a whole. And that we really need to be helping people make the connections between the animals that we're providing them, because people inherently want to come and see animals. They inherently socialize as a family group to do this. And understanding that means that we've got a platform to help them understand the next level of how to save these wild spaces that are being demolished at a rapid rate for various reasons.
You mentioned accredited zoos. Can you talk a little second about that?
Yes. Way back, I think in the 1950s, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums started. It was under a slightly different name at that time. It's evolved over time. It was an association of zoo professionals who were saying, we need to do more. We need to do better. We need to help each other out. We need to stop competing. And we need to make sure that we are doing the right things. It was also driven in those early years by wanting to make sure they were ahead of the ball so the government didn't come in and regulate them, which everybody Right. would rather be self-regulating than regulated by some other entity, especially by people who may not understand you at all. Those were the very, very early years, decades ago, but that has eventually evolved to the place where they then created an accrediting body. And that accreditation means that they will come in every 5 years and inspect your facility for everything. Your business side, how you take care of your animals, your conservation work, you know, your guest services, your finances, your governing authority, everything. They look at it all. And so the Association of Zoos and Aquariums in the United States has become the world's leader of associations with the strictest accrediting requirements of anybody. So Oh, wow. What we want people to look for is that gold seal of approval, so that when they go to those zoos and aquariums, they know that they're making a difference for all of the right reasons. These aren't people who are just providing an animal to make a quick buck so they can get to the movies. No, these are people who are really trying to make a difference for the globe. And again, that goes back to what we really need to be standing for right now.
So what do you think the next steps are, as far as you talked about accreditation and the AZA, or the group that does that in the United States? Like what is the future? Where are zoos going? What is the next step for zoos?
Well, we have to keep doing more, and we have to keep working with all of the other operations that are across the globe, literally. Right now, I'm on the World Association of Zoos and Aquariums Council, and that board of trustees, basically. And the World Association is a slightly different association than the one in the Americas, but it's there to try to continue to build cultural bridges between all of us. So when you think about the culture of someplace like Japan versus the culture of the United States versus the culture of Europe or South Africa or Australia, people come at it with slightly different approaches in what they feel is the professional animal management or what they find tolerable in the use of animals. In one place, they would be more than happy to allow animals to breed, and then when they were overpopulated, those animals would be culled. Other places put animals on birth control so you aren't breeding them at all. And it comes down to a lot of the temperament of what the society is accepting. What we're trying to do is build a universe that is going to create wild spaces, have all of these different groups working together to find ways to get animals into those locations, to work with all of our other government friends to stop trafficking and stop bad things that end up happening to animals, the poaching and the killing and the things that go on, to support in creating environments that allow wildlife and wild places to thrive. I mean, one of the most interesting things with the pandemic is that animals are starting to take over some of the areas that they were displaced from. It's great to see wallabies romping down a city street.
So what do you think about relationship to biophilia and, in fact, this phenomenon of animals coming closer to us during the pandemic? Do you think that the world will change, or our attitudes towards nature will change at all as a result of this pandemic?
Well, I don't know. We're a pretty stubborn species. I I'd like to think that people will. I would like to think that this has given us opportunity to move our opinions and our direction along to create responsible management and have governments come along and support that. You know, there are a lot of things. So to answer your question, will people change? I think there will be some changes. And I'm hoping that those of us who are looking at giving wildlife an even better chance can find a way to put that into the fabric of who we are and move us forward. You know, you're always going to have basics going on out there. People need to eat. People need to take care of their kids. People are going to take advantage of whatever's in their environment to do those things. And that's right. They need to be looked after, but we need to be smarter in our way to create the balance. And how can we do that? It's kind of like the early years of Africa slowly moving from the hunting to the tourism. Stop shooting with a gun and start shooting with a camera. It wasn't quite the same thrill, and you didn't have the head to stick on your wall at home and brag to your friends about, but you could put the photo on your wall and show how close you got. And then hopefully they understand that the money that they spent doing that went further than just their personal edification. It went back into the reserves and the preserves and was spent in keeping those wild places natural.
You know, you've been doing this a long time. It sounds like you started on a trout farm, which I think that's really cool. I have to ask, what is your favorite animal at the zoo? And we won't tell them. They won't hear this.
Oh, okay. Well, I think my favorite animal at the zoo are the cougars.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And it's not so much that I'm a cat fan as I'm those cougars fan. Were rescued from a mother that had been killed in a gunshot wound or a car or something like that. And there were like four of them that came to live with us, and two remain. The other two moved off to other places. And they are just so interesting. They come out there in their tawny fur and those big paws, and they're playful and romping around and ripping up all the enrichment that we provide for them. They're like a couple of kittens. And yet they are big cats.
Right, yeah.
They are an alpha predator, so I'm impressed.
Yes, exactly. And that they also, that they feel confident enough to, you know, and that these cougars can have that joyous time with being animals that have such a huge home range.
Yes.
That's great.
You know, it really is pretty cool. And a lot of that goes back to the keepers and understanding the animals themselves, because we provide all kinds of things for them. It's like having really smart children. If you don't keep them busy, you know, the animals face finding ways to keep them inspired to live a really happy life when there's limits with other things. Like I said, it's kind of like having a really smart kid. You got to just keep ahead of them and really keep working at it.
That kind of leads to, we didn't really touch on this, but as far as animal welfare, I know is a huge, I would say, goal in what we do with our captive animals. And I know you guys are kind of leading the way in animal welfare issues. Do you have anything to say about that as far as your the zoo and the animals there?
Well, animal welfare is really an intensely important pillar to being an accredited zoo. It has to be there. And really reaching out now to go so much farther in understanding animals at almost at the visceral level, not at just the psychological or the scientific level. It's really understanding them and figuring out what's impacting them, and also recognizing things happen that we may not even be aware of. So what happens when you start a construction project and then all of a sudden you're finding certain animals are spending all their time in the farthest area of their enclosure away from the noise? What kind of research or impact did we do to see how uncomfortable our actions would be in creating the life for that particular animal? So those are the questions that we're asking now regularly. And we actually have a complete welfare committee All of our teams are assigned to do regular welfare assessments. They are required to look at anything unusual that might be going on or changing out there. And we do follow-ups to see if we can make a difference. Just, you know, examples are what happens when we see something happening, like what you were talking about. So kind of summing that up, basically looking at the impact of things that we may not be thinking about directly and focusing on those gives us an answer to how we should be making their lives better. Mm. And an example is when an animal might start a stereotypic behavior, like, you know, like moving in the same pattern. We all do it. We have certain stereotypies that the world wouldn't necessarily want to claim that, but driving the same way to work every day is a stereotypy. You do that and you come home, and you do that again and you come home. You aren't going to change it up until they put detour signs in your way. And all of a sudden your synapses are going and you're saying, how am I going to make this work? The same thing is needed for animals to get them a chance to explore their other characteristics and to have fun and to do different stuff. So giving the polar bears their favorite fish treat inside a frozen ice bucket, they have to watch melt down and chew and bite away, is something that's going to keep them involved and give them a chance to do their hunting characteristics and everything else. So it's pretty cool.
E.O. Wilson has this concept, and he published a book entitled Half Earth. And the book is, it's Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life. And in it, he proposes this concept that if we could protect or set aside half of the planet, you know, 50-50, half of the planet for wildlife and wild places that's not developed sort of with people in control and development, that would be a good goal to preserve biodiversity and to preserve nature. And it just seems to me, it strikes me that the North Carolina Zoo, the way it's developed and the way it has so much space to work with, it seems like it sort of fits that bill pretty easily. Do you have any comments on that, or what do you think about that concept?
Well, I certainly agree that wild spaces have got to be set aside. How you accomplish that, given all of the unique boundaries that humans tend to want to create between country lines and state lines and city lines and even your own property lines, makes it a challenge to figure that out. But it has to be the case if we want our planet to survive. You've got to set aside space and you've got to protect the uniqueness of that space. The consequences of not taking that effort may not be felt by us in our generation or even our children, but it will be felt. And it will be felt in such a way that we may end up living in glass domes, wishing that we could grow a plant and wondering what those animals were like back then. So this kind of thoughtfulness, I think, is incredibly important to our future. When you look at the North Carolina Zoo, I am sure that those concepts weighed heavily on the original designers, because the original designers' work is still evident there. Over 40 years ago, they were thinking way outside the box, looking at creating natural habitats so people could understand the relationships between plants and animals and spaces and themselves for their knowledge and for the better good of all. So literally, we have a complete horticultural department whose only job is to try to find like plants to go in these spaces, so that they may not be the African plants that would come over here, but they're going to be very similar plants that would survive here, and put those together with the animals in the space so that people really understand it.
Wow. So that's quite a creative job to say what plant is like this and what feels similar to the animal. What an incredible career on the plant likeness finder. That's incredible. I'm wondering if there's anything else you might like to add or anything we haven't covered so far?
I guess I would just like to go back to what's the point? You know, what is the point? And I have been a believer for a very long time that all of our nonprofit organizations, all of the things that people support, whether it's the symphony or the art museum or the science museum or the history museum or a zoo or an aquarium, we're all there because people want us there. We wouldn't exist if they didn't want us there. We couldn't. And so with their help, how can we be there for them, but then take them to the next level of enlightenment? What is the point? What are we really trying to accomplish? If all we're trying to accomplish at a zoo is to grab an animal and then show it off to somebody and say, this is what it looks like and this is how long its tail is, that doesn't go very far and doesn't last very long when you're looking at a world that is in need of support and help and the need of enlightened people who are going to say, you know what, we aren't putting up with that anymore. We're going to be doing it this way. We want to make a difference. We want to make sure these animals are there for my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren. That's kind of why I'm here. I want to know what's the point, and I want to keep doing the point. And to me, the point is saving the wild world.
Incredible. And what a satisfying career. We've been talking to Pat Simmons, Director and CEO of the North Carolina Zoo. Thank you, Pat. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you very much. I've loved every minute.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast, a production of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. You can listen or subscribe at anchor.fm/The Biophilia Podcast, or you can come to our website, naturalsciences.org. You can also visit the museum in beautiful downtown Raleigh. Details on our website.